The 82-game preseason is finally in the books, and it's time for the real season. Don't miss out on any of the NBA playoff action at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA. From the play-in tournament through the finals, DraftKings Sportsbook has you covered with same-game parlays, live betting, odds boost, and so much more. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code POINT. Forward. New customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets instantly. That's code POINT FORWARD. Only on DraftKings. Crown is yours.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or West Virginia, visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas, 21 plus, age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.co/bball for eligibility and deposit restriction terms and responsible gaming resources.
Your body is unique. So why would you settle for a weight loss plan that's one size fits all? Noom is the weight management program that takes into account your biology to build a custom plan just for you. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com and check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Point Forward, your favorite podcast.
Point Forward.
I'm Andre Iguodala here with my main man, Evan Turner. We have a lot to talk about today, but before we start, please be sure to follow us on all platforms where you listen to your podcast at Point Forward. Today's episode, we enjoyed a conversation with two very interesting gentlemen. Brett Winton, chief futurist from ARK Invest, joined us for this week's edition of Money Moves. House of Strauss creator and sports journalist, who I got to know a little bit while he harassed us in our glory days with the Warriors, Ethan Strauss. Point Forward is sponsored by DraftKings. Stay tuned because you'll hear more about DraftKings and all I have to offer throughout the show. DraftKings, the crown is yours.
Point Forward.
Do you think Ryan was too heavy? Like, I'm hearing excuses because I missed a fight.
I don't think Ryan was too heavy. I think he's 143 pounds at very least. You hear about Devin Haney inflating to 160 every fight, you know, every fight day, and he's fighting at 140. So the last fight he had, he literally, that's what I'm saying.
Really?
So, like, I think it was more strategy because, in my personal opinion, Devin lives like a boxer, Ryan doesn't. You see, Ryan made 135 when he fought Gervonta last summer, so it wasn't like it was a big thing. I just think he learned his lesson. It's like, I don't want to feel weak. Like, I can win the fight. I just don't want to feel weak. And we never fought, but I guess, man, I'm hydrated and feeling weaker. And, like, you know, to a certain extent, a 2 or 3 pound difference is everything. And I think one thing that Devin Haney does is he inflates up to 20 pounds. And if you ain't at that level, you know what I mean? And I think Ryan knew that a heavier weight can really affect Devin because Devin's chin has been tested tremendously at 130 and 135. If Lomachenko was any bigger, he would have knocked Devin out the same way. You know what I mean? He would have dropped Devin numerous times.
Sure.
Just, Lomachenko was 135 fighting that man, and Devin was 160. So it was a
– I don't think people realize that 25 pounds is a lot.
I respect what people be doing. I never like when dudes drop down and be like, man, I walk around in heavyweight, but I'm fighting middleweight. You know what I mean? I'm not doing that to my – I damn near killed myself trying to drop.
Yeah. It's like a handicap.
Yeah.
So what's the next fight we need to see? Is it Shakur and Gervonta?
I think Shakur
– Hey, hold on. I'll say this first. When do we get in a world where in boxing where I think they're having struggles? It's like LIV and PGA is making golf worse right now. But in boxing, the problem with boxing is people think the only way you can have a successful career is if you go undefeated. Like, they don't work like that. And I think it's better if it goes in reverse. Just fight the best and we'll have a
better boxing. One thing that's occurring right now, and, you know, hats off to Ryan Garcia because he jumped right back in with the one loss, was not being afraid to take the fight. You know what I'm saying? You see guys try to step up and do that, you know, tremendously. But I think one thing that he's done with this win is go from, you know, killing that narrative of, you know, not being able to be a big draw without, a perfect record. But then at the same time, throwing Devin Haney, still a champion, one of the best pound-for-pound boxers in the world, in that water to, you know, freely swim and be like, I already got one loss. I can take another and, you know, chase, you know, Tank or Shakur. But I think Paul's just foursome is going to be pretty crazy in the next couple of years. I'm happy for Ryan. He's going to go back and do that rematch. At very least, you'll probably see a trilogy with them over the course of this year. And then from there, I feel like the winner of that just Tank. But I feel like you already seen Tank and Shakur shout out Ryan. He said, "Give me my Tank." Was like, "Yo, get my fight house ready." Basically, like my camp will be ready, man. You earned your shot.
But who was Shakur fighting?
Man, I forgot. Shakur's still on the outside. He had that Devin Haney. He had the opportunity to fight Devin Haney like a few months ago, but he turned down a fight due to the purse. But I know for sure Devin was trying to get Shakur was trying to get a Devin. But it sounds like Ryan's wanting to fight anybody. So I feel as though whoever's holding on with Devin, they'll both go after Ryan and get that big payday.
For sure. Hey. Okay. Copy.
Point. Forward.
Most weight loss programs focus on restriction and inflexible routine, which is why most diets fail. But Noom isn't a diet. It's a weight management program that uses psychology and biology to help you develop healthy, sustainable habits. Noom believes that weight loss starts with the brain, and their daily lessons are tailored to help users understand the science behind food cravings and eating choices. Whether you want to lose weight, increase physical activity, meet a health goal, or simply change the way you think about food, Noom can help you build healthy habits while still enjoying your favorite foods. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com and check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Hey there, it's Matt Norlander with the CBS Sports Eye on College Basketball podcast. And yes, we are in the thick of the college hoop season. Our pod runs at least three times a week and covers everything you need to know, from the power conference team to the mid-majors, the scoops, the stories, game predictions, previews, huge recaps, everything. We cover it all. To find us, search Eye on College Basketball podcast wherever you get your pods.
Point. Forward.
Well, as we talk about the top foursome, let's get into the NBA award finalists. And so DraftKings and their odds on all the various awards, and we finally have a finalist. We've been talking about it. Last week we spoke about it. Who are the finalists for, you know, as MVP, Defensive Player of the Year, Most Improved, Rookie of the Year, Sixth Man of the Year, Clutch Player of the Year.
I keep forgetting about that shit too. And Steph Curry is always on it too.
And Coach of the Year. I never thought about
Davis,
that.
And,
and Coach of the Year. Right. And so, yeah, he's finally on it. But we've been talking about it. And so there might be some surprises. And then there's also some shoe-ins. Let's start with MVP. And so the finalists are Luka, Shai, and the Joker.
Man, to be honest with you, if I had to pick somebody for my MVP, I'd really love to see SGA get it. Like we spoke on last week, bro, what he's doing with that young team, the level he's playing at, I think they compared it to like the 88 Jordan season, which is one of the craziest seasons of all time. Yep. His numbers is crazy. I think even at the beginning of the year, how he started off going up against, you know, the golden child, Steph Curry, and really setting the tone from there was really unbelievable. Yeah. Especially considering when you've seen some of these people have like such a hot flash. Like you look at the Tyrese Maxey and they weren't able to keep it up. Pause. And now you're looking now that this dude was able to, finish third in the West with like literally a college team. I just think when you're able to, give it away, because clearly this is like a Jokic league, apparently, if you listen to George Karl, that you got to give it, you know what I mean? You got to be able to give it to people that are deserving. I think SGA has been ridiculously deserving and with his team that he's carrying is unreal.
And they finished first in the West.
Oh, OKC finished first. Oh, I'm tweaking.
Yes.
Get that man an MVP. I didn't even know why we were still arguing about this.
That's why
we had this conversation last week. I mean, this might not mean much, but you got the point for MVP. That's yet.
Yeah, true story. But the interesting part about that, too, is that New Orleans are going to test them.
I believe so. My man, Steve.
They went 5 minutes without a field goal in game one, and I was locked in. I know there's been a lot of discussions around basketball, around defense, and you know the refs can turn, or NBA can turn the water on and off on scoring. It could be 150, it could be 88, they decide. But like I think that with the game was like I'm watching the officials on a different level now. I'm watching them off the ball during timeouts, during reviews. Like I'm watching the refs closely now. That was a well-ref game. There was a few calls, superstar calls, but the benefit of doubt was given to superstar. I'm fine with that. It was an interesting challenge by OKC late in the game. That was a jump ball, a 7-1 guy versus a, I forgot who jump ball with New Orleans, but OKC had the was favored to win the tip. They challenged, ended up being off OKC. New Orleans gets the ball. It was crazy. And I felt like that was a big play, but they ended up pulling the game out. But you could see the nervousness. And it got a little shaky in OKC. I mean, they haven't been in the playoffs in 5 years. Maybe it's the Cobwebs they get out. And so that series, you know, certain series, you know, we keep it a buck. Certain series I ain't watching. Like, I'm going to waste my time watching this series. And I think people preview that. Like, I'm watching that series. I'm not watching that series. The OKC-New Orleans series was an interesting one. Small markets. People may not be as familiar with Shai. People definitely don't know Brandon Ingram in the manner that they should. Zion's out, but that game was really good. That was a really good game, and I hope it keeps going with the battle. It was the only game that wasn't a blowout.
So you say there's certain games you're not watching or series. So why is that Orlando versus Cleveland Cavaliers?
Who said I wasn't watching it?
No, because I watched the game. I watched the game the other day, and I enjoyed it. But I'm like, man, this is getting boring as hell. Like, you know what I mean? I'm like, I'm probably the only man on earth watching it.
Well, I think you got two young teams with Orlando and Cleveland. Not a lot of playoff experience. Like Donovan's been in the playoffs, but has Donovan ever been favored to win a series? Yeah. It's a little different,
right? You know what's so crazy? Even you bring up Donovan, and I'm a big fan of Donovan, but Donovan was talked about and regarded, in my personal opinion, at one point, how they were talking about Anthony Edwards right now, and it kind of threw me off. And now, like, I'm at the point now where I'm like, good, like. I think my thing against Donovan was like, no, he's really good. But like, they talking about like, he's like young Jordan and now or like D Wade. And I feel that that's, it fits more accurately now that they're hyping up Anthony Edwards.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, but it's going to be interesting. They get out the first round and then they look to that who's won in or Boston. They got to see Boston next. I think he's been in the league for a while on Donovan's side. And if you don't really make a large impression in the playoffs in terms of advancing and giving to your team a real shot at least getting to the conference finals. Yeah. You know how the league is. Yeah. Like, they're going to run it up in terms of their energy behind you from the get-go. If you show some promise as a rookie, they're going to follow you. They're going to give you all the praise. They're going to build up that narrative for you. But it can fizzle out if you don't make it too far. Like, if you don't see, like, if you're not, like, one of those guys that can be like, whoa, they're first in their conference. They got a real chance of making a run at it. You know, MVP. You know, USA, Team USA. I mean, what Anthony Edwards has been doing, took, the momentum he took from last summer. And I think we've been saying it for the longest. We might have been first. And people call me, you know, I'm always saying something people call hot takes. It wasn't a hot take. Like, I was saying Anthony Edwards, he could be better than Dwayne Wade. Dwayne Wade's a top five shooting guard of all time. People were like, what? He always talking crazy. Now they're talking about Michael Jordan.
Yeah, that's crazy. Well, speaking of Anthony Edwards, and you brought up like the one little thing of being able to be first in conference and all that. We look at like the MVP conversation and like look at Tatum. Don't you think he kind of got snubbed in the situation? He averaged 27, 28 per year. His team won the league by a month, basically. They're basically in practice. So, like, what more could he do to really be taken into consideration, especially on top of everything he's already done in the past of like just, you know, the accolades, what he's been able to do, like to not make it in the top three in the MVP voting. And, you know, you were at 15, you know, 2018 losses on the season is kind of crazy. Like, what do you think about that?
I really don't know. And I was just thinking about it. I had my ET thinking cap on. I was saying, I mean, he likes it. Yeah. He got that. I mean, good looking, good looking kid. Like, what are we, like, what's missing? You know, he's selling his shoe. He's got the most endorsements in the league. You know, he's got his own ruffles. Like, he's doing it the right way. He takes care of the game. He plays hard every single night. Like, he doesn't miss any games. I really don't know. I mean, besides him not shooting free throws, like, no, I don't know.
And that's a real conversation to have because when I'm looking, I'm like, well, Well, does winning, like, not like the James Harden thing, but like, does winning not mean anything? Like, do you keep moving a banister? But like, he's going to keep doing his thing. But I was Tatum. I'm like, bro, I'm averaging 28 and winning by a long shot. And you don't want to self-campaign, but it's like, you know how hard it is to average 28 on this team? We're all loaded. Pause. But I'm still doing my job. Yeah. So
I have no idea. What's the last Boston MVP we've had? Maybe something against Boston. They have some killers.
I don't know. Larry Bird. Yeah, that was it. Larry Legend was the last one, maybe. Damn. You seen what Anthony Davis said the other day? You seen him finish the top three for the Defensive Player of the Year award. So I believe it was Anthony Davis. So they came out with the Kia, obviously the finalists for the Defensive Player of the Year award. So it's Rudy Gobert. It's obviously Wemby. And I believe the last person is Bam Adebayo. I believe when he asked Anthony Davis about it, he's like, bruh, the league just doesn't like me. I've been the best defensive player in the league for a long, long time. And this year, the frustration, he's played 75 games, the dominance he's been trying to have. I mean, he's been dominating his whole year. So how do you feel about that? Especially when you look at guys like yourself that didn't make an all defensive team for like until you went somewhere sexy to go do it. You know what I mean?
Pick me to play Team USA because of defense. And I never made a first team all defense. Never finished finalist defensive player of the year. Like, I knew I was good at that. Like, I knew it. I think with AD, it's the Lakers thing. And I'm going to be honest, it's like, you know, playing for the Lakers comes with a different type of, you know, narrative and being under that microscope. Anthony Davis had an amazing year.
Like,
he had a great year. And he'll have 33 and 18, and they'd be like, AD, that's what you're supposed to be doing. And I go back to, like, Moses Malone. He said, man, I averaged 33 and 15, and I was making $200,000. They going to give me $1 million. What you expect me to do? I can't do no better than this. And they acting like it's just supposed to be, like, on command. Like, you know how good the league is?
But you also think, I guess, is the result of I feel like 8 years ago or 10 years ago, Charles Barkley looked crazy. It was like, in 5 years, this will be the best player in the world. And he's referring to Anthony Davis. So I think sometimes when it comes down to it, it's kind of like karma for not, I guess, defiantly or like, you know, doing that and making that so obvious, you know?
Yeah.
So.
And he's a little quiet. He doesn't, you know, give you more than just going out there and playing and doing his job. There's no character to it. I'm just speaking from the world we live in because I'm anti, like, all the antics and all that nonsense. And then, you know, anytime he gets poked in the eye, it's blown out of proportion, like AD out again. Like you said, he played 75 games this year. Like, what are we talking about? Like, I agree with that sentiment. Like AD controlled the entire paint. He had the Dwight Howard effect, and people don't understand that. It's almost like, you know, you see the player rankings. You know, you saw the recent player rankings by The Athletic, and Kyrie Irving is always the most skilled player that we've ever seen. But then still, and it's like, you know, I love what USA basketball has going on. Grant Hill is one of my favorite players of all time, top three, top four. But Kyrie didn't make the USA team, and I feel some type of way about it.
I think there's supposed to be a certain level where, like, you don't get judged because you're able to call and be like, hold on, bro, who the fuck is you, button? You know what I mean? And, like, just be like, bro, stop, G. Don't tell me shit. I'm showing up. I'll be on the bus, fam. Like, stop, G. Like, y'all. You talking about the same like thing where people were screaming my name and I could play 8 or 9 years ago and I'm still that dude? Like, since then, Kyrie has shot three seasons in 90, 50, 40. With all due respect, G, that's why God didn't make me that cold. Because do you know? There's no such thing as Grant Hill calling me, telling me I'm playing on Team USA. No, I will. It's in France this year. I will be there. It's in London. I will be there. It's in Japan. I will be there. I'll be like Diana Taurasi. It'll be like my 87 tour.
I like it. I'm not placing all the blame on Grant.
You got
either,
to. Because
I think there's more than that. I think Grant voted for him.
To be honest with you, if your boy Steve don't do what he's supposed to this year, I'm a vote to have Brad Stevens as the all-time coach. So tell your mans, all right? And I'll just show him. Yo, you think he'll really start Anthony Edwards?
I'll send
this
the message.
Anthony Edwards.
That's the hard part. That's the hard part about. But Steve kind of got it going. Like he set precedents. It's the word of the day. It's been the word of the last 5.5 months. Precedents. Steve has set precedents in terms of somebody got to go to the bench.
Yeah, but then when you break it down, you can set precedents, and it got to work. That, yo, so you see the most improved player list, you peep that.
Bro, we totally forgot about somebody, and I apologize to him because
yo, he the coldest.
Got it. Sanguine. Oh,
yo, he's so cold, G. And this interview is funny as hell.
He cold. I never listened to interviews like that.
Because he's so cold. I think he's from Turkey, but like, not saying I can speak, but it's like, he speaks like a broken English, but when it comes out, it's like the most fluid, like coldest shit ever. You're like, oh, that's how you feel, man. But it's so modest.
He got it.
You understand what I'm saying? And it's like, no, dude, you're that juice, dog. Like, now Jokic is struggling with you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think when you do Sagon or Sagwin, he had a crazy year last year as well. Shout out to him, but I still think my man Kobe White is the one that should be, you know, getting to that level.
Tyrese took off, though. I forgot. I mean, Tyrese was so good that we didn't even have him in the discussion. He was like, oh, it's good to be talked about.
Yeah, I feel like when last year, like, what did he average last year? 18? That's what I'm saying. But when you say most improved, like, if you average 18, like, you could have averaged 25. Oh, yeah, you were just a third in line. Like, you know what I mean? So,
I got you.
I would love to see my man Kobe White get that. And then who else do you see? The Clutch Award. Who's on the Clutch Award? It's
Steph Curry, DeMar DeRozan, and
I'm not going to lie. So you got to give it to Shea. But DeMar did hit a lot of big-time shots this year, G. Like the 22.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, the 22 games too. The Bulls won. He hit 15 game winners.
No, I agree. Who gets the Defensive Player of the Year award? We talked about AD, who didn't make the finalist, but I mean, who we giving it to?
I personally, to be honest with you, I want to give it to Wemby. Like, I think it's a big difference in what he's able to do. But we spoke about the Athletic earlier, and they did like an anonymous player poll, and somebody had on there as the most overrated out of 128 player votes was Rudy Gobert.
No, I don't like that poll only because, you know, to the players, to the guys, you know. But, you know, I'm holding our guys accountable. But, you know, players, we should only do our polls and we should only release them internally. We should never give our player polls out to anybody
else. Like what the GMs do, but they do kind of publicly. But, no, I'm totally
correct. Like, we can release it publicly ourselves, but we're not giving it to any other platform.
I think that's just a result of, you know, the NBA season kind of the headlines somewhat getting repetitive and then too much access for a nerd. You know what I mean? And then from there, you take the hit the streets.
Story.
But, no, to each their own. One thing, not just saying underrated, but always respecting people, the players vote the MVP. You know what I'm saying? Like a couple years ago when we did the NBA Players Award, and I think James Harden didn't win league MVP, but he won the Players Award MVP, and I felt like that spoke volumes.
Yep.
And even, I guess, in this year, even though it contradicts what we say, the players, Jokic got 126, which is crazy. So that's something to really tap into. What about Coach of the Year? Who you got for Coach of the Year?
I'm giving it to Mark. I don't even know how to say his name. Doggenaut?
Yeah, buddy. From OKC, G.
Hey,
that's an understatement, man. Shout out to Chris Stenson. Oh, Jamal Mosley, bro. To be honest with you, I never thought that organization would turn around.
So Wemby is just shoo-in for Defensive Player of the Year. Me personally, I think Bam should get it this year before Wemby wins it 10 years in a row.
Yeah, I'm into that too. I'm not against that. No, that's a real thing when you sit here and people be showing up. It's like, I was there when John Wall was a media darling and we go to All-Star weekend and he not started in the rookie All-Star game. Kyrie is. I mean, rookie sophomore All-Star game the year before John was MVP. They had him doing all that Dougie shit. So, like, when you start breaking down marketing and all that, it's like, all right, bro, let me get my shit before y'all get the act in the pool.
True story.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, and then last but not least, Sixth Man of the Year. I think we missed one person. We missed your favorite player off the bench. So, Malik Monk, we spoke about. Yep. Nas Reed, we spoke about. And Bobby Portis, who had a great game one. Indiana, Milwaukee
series. Milwaukee Trailblazers.
Bobby Portis had a great
game. Dame Lillard, baby.
Yes, yes. So, with them three, Portis, Reed, Monk, who's your
man? I got Nas Reed, bro. The 6'10 Kyrie. Did you see the Euro on a fast break with the Kyrie jelly?
Man, now it's really been like that for a long time. I saw a clip of him in high school. Man, who this big-ass kid that ain't got no business on the perimeter dribbling the ball too much? And 3-4 years later, he was in the league. I said, oh, that was a dude.
And I think, you know, sometimes when you're breaking it down, Bobby Portis has been a great sixth man and everything. But, you know, their success hasn't been as great as it has been in the past couple of years. But, I mean, Naz Reid has just been tremendous. The talent is there. I think sometimes when you look at Malik Monk, you look at two people that can stand on their own. And I think when it comes to hoopers, that's what you love. Not saying Bobby Portis can't, but you see Malik Monk, he can mess around average 20. If he had a C.J. McCollum-type opportunity, he could be C.J. McCollum modern day. You know what I mean?
And the discipline, too. Somebody going to pay him. Yeah. Somebody going to pay him in the summer. A lot of money.
Not a normal way of scoring, dog. Like, you understand what I'm saying? Like, he's just that talented. You do the same thing with Naz Reid, in a sense. So those dudes really go get it on their own in that system. And, you know, I've always been, you know, favorable in that.
True story.
Point. Forward.
DraftKings has been so gracious enough to shoot us the odds for some of the postseason NBA awards. And to start, we'll go with the Finals MVP award. You also have the Eastern Conference Finals MVP award and the Western Conference Finals MVP award, which I keep forgetting about as well. But on the Finals MVP side, we got Jason Tatum with the best odds at a +240, followed by Jokic at a +320. And we had Jaylen Brown, that might surprise some folks, for Finals MVP at a +900. And then Anthony Edwards sits at fourth place with a +1600. And the way he performed in Game 1 versus Phoenix, you got to look at him seriously. Kawhi, who missed Game 1, is in fifth at a +1800, followed by Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, +1800, same as Kawhi. Then you got Porzingis. The Celtics have a bunch of guys up here at a +2200. Then Giannis at a +22, as well as Luka at a +22. Joel Embiid, Paul George, Jamal Murray, Embiid and George at a +2500. Jamal Murray at a +2800. KD +3000. Dame +3500. LeBron +4000, along with Brunson and Booker at +4000. And then Drew Holiday, another Celtic, at a +4500. Tyrese Maxey and James Harden ended out at a +5000. And then we move into Eastern Conference Finals MVP odds. Tatum, he's at a -110. What I've learned, whenever you see a minus, that means you got to spend a lot of money to get your money, because they are damn near a shoo-in. Then Jaylen Brown at a +500. You got Giannis, Joel, Dame, Jalen Brunson is at a +1100. Porzingis is up there. Donovan Mitchell, we spoke about earlier, +2000. Maxey, Drew, Derek White, Andrew are at a +4000. A lot of Celtics. Bam, Haliburton, Garland is up here. Bobby Portis has better odds than Ben Sherrill, which makes sense considering the odds of getting there as they round out the Eastern Conference Finals MVP odds. And then we move into the Western Conference MVP odds. Jokic takes the crown as the best odds at a +145, followed by Shai at a +650. Kawhi, Anthony Edwards, Luka, Paul George, Kevin Durant +1300, Jamal Murray, Devin Booker at +2000, LeBron at a +2000, AD at a +4500, as well as James Harden. Michael Porter Jr. at a +5000, and Cat is Karl-Anthony Towns at a +6500. Aaron Gordon makes a list, and so the Denver Nuggets have the same as the Boston Celtics in their effect on their essentially starting five, having great odds. And then the great underrated Kyrie Irving rounds it out at +7000. So those are your postseason odds.
Point. Forward.
The 82-game preseason is finally in the books, and it's finally time for the real season. Don't miss out on any of the NBA playoff action at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA. From the play-in tournament through the finals, DraftKings Sportsbook has you covered with same-game parlays, live betting, odds boost, and so much more. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code POINTFORWARD. New customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets instantly. That's code POINTFORWARD. forward. Only on DraftKings. The crown is yours.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or West Virginia, visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas, 21 plus, age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.co/bball for eligibility and deposit restriction terms and responsible gaming resources.
Point. Forward. Point. Forward.
Without further ado, a guy I got to know in Golden State when everyone decided to jump on a train and try to boost themselves up in their career using our likeness. But this guy was very, very unique and interesting and always had a different question that seemed to he liked to rattle somebody. But I always had a respect for him because he wasn't afraid to ask any question. And when you look back, there was a method to the madness, and it was beyond, you know, just being in front of the camera and a character. He really dove deep into his work. It seemed like he cared about his work, and he's always writing the articles that, you know, everyone's afraid to tackle. And it's a science and data behind it. So I got a lot of respect for him, and I hope that he does really well in all his endeavors. Y'all welcome Ethan Strauss.
Point. Forward.
We are turning the tables today. Very excited about this one. I'm interested to see how his interactions with me are, considering the interviewee abusive-like relationship with athletes and journalists. We welcome Ethan Sherwood Strauss to Point Forward. Ethan is on the Substack platform right now. Started off with ESPN as a beat writer, then he went over to The Athletic. And now he is a director consumer through the Substack network platform, which I've been looking at over the years, trying to figure out that business. And so I feel like we got a ton to talk about. We've had an interesting relationship. I've come to really respect you, your mind, your not just basketball acumen, your business acumen, how you've been able to maneuver in the space, disruptions in the space, how you pick topics. I actually subscribe to the House of Strauss myself. And then you had a really good interview. You had a good pod with a guy who I do not like, but I got so much great information from that pod, and, you know, new level of respect for him as well. I won't say who it was. I love all my players now with the role that I sit in. But just to kick things off, kind of give us your background and then how you got to where you are now.
Oh, man, that's a big question. And thank you for the kind words. Out of college, I didn't really know what to do with my life. I was probably just going to be a lawyer because that's what people do when they're better with words than numbers. But a friend of mine said he heard about a job in the NBA. It was called media monitoring, where basically the job was you wake up at 3:30 a.m. every day and read everything about the NBA and send a memo to David Stern back then. And so I moved to New York, and I didn't know anything about anything. I just knew I liked basketball, and it was, you know, friend of a friend. It was $17,000 for that year, and it was probably the worst job I ever had, but it just gave me the idea of, whoa, there are these people who write about the league. Oh, they're called beat writers. Wait, you're telling me that they get to sit, you know, back then courtside? You know, and then I was seeing how people were doing it. You know, Brian Windhorst had this this microphone like the one I'm holding right here. And he'd do these post game things because he was always very smart about what the next wave was going to be. And I was just observing it. But ultimately, I kind of burned out on it. And I sent in my 2 weeks and I was about to quit. And they said, okay, but we just need you for this one thing. We got one job that we need you to do here at the NBA. We've got draft night. And the way they do draft night is they have workers for the NBA shepherd these guys. Maybe you guys remember this. They have you like go up to the lottery pick and make them do a couple hours of interviews, the interview car wash. Mm-hmm. So you guys did this, right? You guys did that kind of thing. So my job was to take whoever the fifth pick was that night. And this is 2009. Whoever they are, can you remember?
I'm trying to think. 2009. Okay, let me go back.
You
to
said
that.
The fifth pick.
The fifth pick.
I know who the fifth pick was.
Pick in 2009.
I know who mine was.
But I'm talking about 2009. Who had
Minnesota
it,
Timberwolves?
Ew, man. So was it Rubio?
Yes, But that wasn't how it was supposed to go.
That was a that was a nasty draft. That was a, David Kahn is in Paris because of that. Shout out to David Kahn.
Well, it wasn't how it was supposed to go. Nobody, I think, thought Rubio was going to be fifth pick. And I remember there were two women who both spoke Spanish who they actually put as the people and the picks that he was supposed to go as. Don't ask me why they didn't just say, you take Ricky Rubio. Like, I don't know why they didn't do it that way, but they didn't. So I don't speak Spanish, to my great shame, because I'm from San Diego. And he doesn't really speak much English, and he's miserable over getting picked by the Wolves. Just miserable.
Wow.
And you could really feel he just felt young, too. He was a teenager, and I was fresh out of college, but he felt younger than me. And it was a crazy situation, because I'm trying to console him. He doesn't really speak English. He's miserable. He wants to talk to his family, and I had to just be like, no, we got to do next interview. And he's like,
Yeah, those interviews are crazy.
Yeah, like, I don't know why it's like that, but they just make guys go from one to the next to the next. And then I'm in this, I don't know if you guys did it this way, but at Madison Square Garden, there's this ballroom, this grand ballroom, where you're on a landline and you call your new team up. And it's like this awkward first date kind of thing. So I'm sitting with Ricky Rubio, and the call happens over the landline, and I feel like I'm on somebody's awkward blind date where they're trying to figure out if he's not going to just flee to Europe and if he's really going to, you know, join the Timberwolves. And I can hear it in the phone call, and he doesn't really speak great English. There's a kind of a translator, and he's sort of saying, all he can really say about Minnesota is, I hear it's cold, and it's just uncomfortable. And it's just, the whole situation was so weird. It was so uncomfortable. I'm behind the scenes of the NBA. And that night I went home and I just wrote everything down about it that I could remember from that night. And I pocketed it for a year. I didn't do anything with it for a year. And a year later, after I moved back to the Bay Area, and I was an intern at some, you know, publication that mostly did politics and whatnot. But I just decided to write it. And I just sent it in to a blog called Free Darko a year later. And it went viral.
Free Darko.
And that's how I got my start. Free Darko. That's how I got my start. It went viral on Free Darko. Deadspin picked it up. And I think it taught me that, well, it taught me that I could do that. I could write something that was interesting to people. But it also taught me that if something is interesting, it's because a lot of people aren't supposed to say it and aren't supposed to reveal it, because the NBA was pissed. They were not happy about what I did, and they made that known. And so those were, you know, a few important lessons to me, which got the ball rolling and got me eventually writing for Warriors World, which got me to ESPN, which got me to where I am today.
Well, speaking of Warriors World and you kind of projecting things and finding stuff that's interesting, you kind of also are known for being one of few people to predict the Warriors' first championship run, right?
Yeah.
So how'd you see that coming, and what made you think that, like, a team of, you know, Steph Curry, I think David Lee was still starting, you know, mm-hmm. being a young Klay Thompson, Andre Iguodala, and you know, Harrison Barnes, I believe. Why'd you believe they could win it?
Yeah, I want to know, too.
It's really simple. Because I was there. Because I was around the situation. I think we get caught up sometimes if somebody's a beat writer. You hear people go, Homer, this person's a Homer. They're sugarcoating things. And that happens. That bias is real. But I would say it's a lot easier to hear a car alarm if you're near the car. You know, it's a lot easier to be quicker to a trend if you're around it. And the reason I was able to make that prediction, and I didn't make that prediction in 2013 or 2012, it's because I saw the preseason games, and people say preseason doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You know, whatever. Maybe often it doesn't. But I could just see that the team was playing totally different, that the way they were passing the ball was completely different, and that something powerfully had shifted. So I don't look at it as I had some sort of, you know, foresight, genius. I didn't predict the Warriors to win in 2022, but I wasn't around the Warriors. I had quit by then. So, you know, I would have if I was around the situation, but that's all it was. It's that I was watching every preseason possession, and that allowed me, and it just indicated the really meaningful change. And then you go through the other thing where you're worried about people thinking you're a homer, and I had that little conversation with myself, And then I thought to myself, well, if I honestly believe this is the case, then I don't want to really respond to the social pressure or worrying what it looks like. I just want to go with what I think is going to happen, because otherwise, why am I even in this industry?
Right, right. So expanding on that, how was your relationship, or how did your relationships with the players form? You know, what were your thoughts going into it? You know, you write this blog, ends up on, what'd you call it? Darko?
Free Darko.
What you call it? What's the Darko one? Okay, so it goes on Free Darko, and now, you know, you're in Warriors world. You're not as in front of the players forward facing as normal, but now you're with ESPN. Yeah. You know, talk to us about the relationship building aspect as a journalist, you know, with a big brand or a big company like ESPN, then The Athletic, and then now being an independent.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's tough to reflect on because I didn't know what I was doing. I think we need to get that out of the way. I mean, I didn't come up traditionally the way Marcus Thompson at The Athletic, who's a great writer and does an incredible job, but he came up in this very traditional way of covering high school football and then rising up the ranks of the newspaper and knowing the ins and outs of how you do it. I was just kind of just freestyling it, just by the seat of my pants. I made stupid mistakes. I took a picture of the took a picture of the whiteboard with the plays on it in pregame once, and Dan Martinez, who was second in command of Raymond Ritter, PR guy, he said, "Look,
he's in Atlanta now."
Yeah, and he said, "Look, I like you, so don't ever do that again, because the punishment for doing that is never having a press pass ever again." And like, you know, if he was an asshole, then my career could have just ended right there. I didn't know though, and he knew that. I just didn't know what you did, what you didn't do. So I don't know if I was so much consciously building relationships the way I should. I was pretty early to Draymond, as was Marcus. For whatever reason, we could just see that he was good in a way that people weren't necessarily willing to accept. And so that, you know, I've gone back and forth with Draymond. We've had our ups and downs. But early, it was really good because it was just a matter of, I thought he was good. I thought he was better than what other people thought. And, you know, not so coincidentally, I had a very bad relationship with David Lee because I thought he wasn't so good relative to what other people thought. It wasn't anything personal. It wasn't anything about personality. You know, I had, you know, this sort of rocky relationship with Harrison Barnes for a similar reason. And then when Harrison came back with another team, it's like bygones are bygones because Harrison's a great dude and there's no reason why we wouldn't get along. But for I have this weird job where I have to talk about how good you are at your job. And it's annoying because I'm some 5'11 nerd who doesn't play basketball, and I can completely understand that perspective. So I think that Draymond, because he was so good and such a magnetic personality, that was an important relationship early on.
So when it came down to that, you talk about trying to gauge your opinions and what you write so you won't come off as a homer. How do you gauge in a sense of not, you know, having that bite you in the ass? Because at the end of the day, David Lee was an NBA All-Star. He's one of the focal points of the team. That could have destroyed you. When you get into it, Draymond, I mean, the whole world goes upside down. That could have destroyed you as well. How did you kind of take that responsibility of having, you know, some type of, you know, class in the writing when it came down to talking about, you know, basketball players, considering the fact you don't really have, you know, the background or experience?
Yeah. I mean, I think it has bit me sometimes. And you're just, it's the Peter Guber, minority owner of the Warriors. He says this thing that I've really taken to heart, which is, there are no rules, but you break them at your peril. You know, like, I often felt that way where I didn't know exactly where I was going to transgress, what rule I was going to break. I think I wrote something about Draymond that there were some good points to it, but I regret the article. I thought it was too much. I thought it was too salacious. And that gets to this other back end of the industry where that was when I was at ESPN and I had a meeting with one of the bosses there. I think they were in town for Super Bowl weekend. And because I was young and foolish, or relatively younger and more foolish, I didn't know that if you just start talking to one of your bosses about stuff around the team, they actually expect you to write it. And then it becomes an order. And so it's, wait a second, now I'm doing this thing about how the team is on a knife's edge with Draymond. And there were some things in that article that was legit and was good writing. But that was one where I felt like it was less respectful than it needed to be. And I think it damaged my relationship with him. And I think to an extent, it damaged my relationship with the team. And I don't regret that there was an article with that angle necessarily, but just the way it was done and the feeling of not even really feeling in control of it myself. Like what I'm doing right now at my own site, what I love is whatever happens for good or for ill, that's what I chose to happen. But sometimes, and I'm not trying to evade responsibility because every time you do something, it's your name on it. You know, you can quit over it if you don't like what's happening. So ultimately it is your responsibility. But I think that was one of the first times I really felt that kind of pressure. And it was less this sense of, oh man, is the team going to be mad at me or, you know, whatever. It's more, did I even choose this? Did I even want this to be what it is?
It's tough because even when you play, you hate to be the bad guy in the locker room, but like you actually know those guys. So imagine being like the beat writer that nobody knows. Like that could be, not say nobody knows, but like just the energy of being like, man, this is the only way I have an in with them. And now they're pissed at me for like a week.
Yeah. It could be easier though. I mean, this is a weird topic to get into, but I feel like when you're kind of a white nerd, just to be frank about it, your access often is a little bit more determined by the coaching level and the NBA ops level and the GM, you know, the GMs of the league. So there is that pressure. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody's both. Everybody's, you know, some locker room, some NBA ops, if they're in that business, but it's tilted depending on what relationships you have. And so, frankly, I think, you know, yes, there were risks to it. Yes, the team could get mad at me, but it didn't necessarily change my relationships with the NBA ops side. So in that way, I think I had it a little bit easier than some people where maybe they are more dependent specifically on the players and getting that cut off is a death sentence.
Well, considering that, what do you think, as being a former beat writer who went off into his own and kind of trailblazing paths, where do you think the future of the beat writers are going? Do you think it'll be more people having a bigger space, bigger say to be, you know, become a bigger personality, or is it, you know, the Ethan Strauss way to go?
Man, it's bad. I mean, there are fewer and fewer beat writers. The beat writer used to be a real established position in the league, and there just aren't as many of them. And you wonder if that's a product of pure economics or if the industry is making a mistake. And I'm a little bit inclined towards the latter because I think there's a hunger for those stories. I was just talking to Tim Kawakami at The Athletic, and his Niners stuff is just doing numbers. And I think we can be honest about that. I don't think I'm hurting him by saying what he's doing is popular. But he's writing just classic, grounded in the locker room, talking to Shanahan, talking to John Lynch, those sorts of stories. And there's a real market for it. But for whatever reason, there's been this loss of faith that there is a market for it. And that's the first thing to go. So it's this whole tradition. It's this whole aspect of the industry that's going away. And there just might not be any 5 years from now, which to me feels like a mistake. And it feels like a market inefficiency that is getting taken advantage of in some respects. But I'm just following the trends and where it's going. And where it's going is not good for the beat writer.
Yeah. Well, what do you think? How does new media affect like the trend of the beat writer and kind of the space for the beat writer, those who haven't been in an environment or like around the locker room in a sense? Do you think the consumer is kind of being overly harsh on what they want to hear or like the level of it? Because you have people that have journalism degrees and they might be getting kicked out of a gig for a guy that, you know, naturally play or in this situation. How you broke into the NBA of talking basketball, you know what I mean? Sometimes it's like the same thing that makes you laugh is the same thing that makes you cry.
No, I think you're making a good point, and it reminds me of something that you said on one of the first episodes of this podcast.
I want to hear it. What is?
You were talking about how you moved into a new neighborhood when you started off your NBA career, and you could almost feel that people were a little uncomfortable, some of the circles you were moving in. And you felt almost sympathetic to it because it was people that reached a certain level in life who might have been nerds in high school, okay? And here you were, the successful jock, and all of a sudden it almost made them feel a little weird about their status. And you might wonder why I'm bringing that up. I think YouTube is advantage to the jocks. I think YouTube, that form of new media, you see a lot of the podcasts that are doing well recently, a lot of the NBA podcasts, are podcasts like this. Now, why would that be? I think part of it, you know, if we're being totally honest about it, maybe jocks are more presentable than nerds, right? So we take a visual medium, you know, you've got that, but also more famous. You're a face. You're somebody people recognize. And so I think that is crowded in a little bit on the nerd domain of being a writer. And it's just so interesting to me how this all goes, how sometimes the nerds will create a technology like Twitter that initially really helps the nerds. But sometimes nerds will create Instagram, which empowers the jock and takes, hey, if you're good looking, you're popular, we just made this technology for you that's going to help you even more. So maybe I'm digressing, maybe I'm talking about crazy things, but I feel like recently the customer is paying more money to the jocks, and the jocks are taking some victories at the expense of the nerds recently, at least.
Well, I want to break that down. So how have you maneuvered from this disruption of nerd versus jock? And I'm just throwing those words in there. I have to say that one can't be the other or vice versa.
Yeah,
but how have you, Kyle, what's been your niche? You know, obviously I'm in the tech space, and, you know, ET and I building this thing have been saying, like, what do we offer that differentiates us from the rest of the crowd? Because everyone's jumped into this space of creating podcasts. And so how have you created the largest basketball pod on Substack? And I think what you say, you're second in sports to a guy up in the Northwest. You know, how have you gone into your business plan, and how has it worked for you, and then where do you plan on going in the future?
It's a great question. I might be third, actually, because Kareem has a Substack, and I don't know if we classify him as the nerdiest jock or the greatest jock nerd or what, but he's also up there. And
arguably the greatest basketball player of all time. They just don't want to talk about
it. It's very interesting. You know, it's very strange that way, but how do I navigate it? I never really thought in terms of it, in terms of how to position myself. I think sometimes it's good just to focus on what you do well and try to optimize it. You know, you can almost figure out your strengths by looking at your weaknesses. And if I look at my own weaknesses, I go, okay, am I a newsbreaker? No, I'm not good at that. That takes a certain kind of relentlessness. And I'm not
And third, Shams.
Yeah, Shams. Whatever Shams has, whatever that guy has, and it is relentless. The way he doesn't even play pickup basketball because he might get a phone call. I don't want to live that life. And I'm not even saying if I made those sacrifices that I would be as good at it. I just don't think I'm good at it that way. And then you think about some other weaknesses you might have or that I might have. And I go, okay, what can I do? Well, I can write. Okay, so that's a strength. And what do people want to read? Stuff I talked about earlier, which is stuff that people don't want out there. I mean, in a way, it's a dirty business. You're going to hurt some feelings, but I'm at my best when I'm finding out something interesting, maybe something everybody doesn't want out there, and I'm conveying it in the way I want to convey it. And that's all I'm trying to do. And my one rule for it is very simple. I need to be interested in it. I don't think a lot of writers ask themselves that question. I mean, it's a very basic question. It's so basic. They get so into the, I'm working on this story, I want to do this story. They don't step back sometimes and go, am I interested in this? Would I be interested in it if somebody said it? It's very key. It's very key. You know, Michael Lewis, I remember I heard an interview with him, and he was being asked about Moneyball, and he was like, how did you know? How did you know this would be so big? And he said, look, nobody indicated to me that the Oakland A's and what they did with calculators was going to be the biggest best-selling sports book ever. I was just interested in it. If you're interested in something, you can make somebody else interested in something. Maybe they won't be.
But what about the algorithm?
What about the algorithm? I mean,
because that seems like that's what everyone's chasing.
I mean, that's a path to death, because the problem with chasing the algorithm is that they change the algorithm. They're not going to change the algorithm of what an interesting story is. Like, that's eternal. That's the Bible. That's just as long as we've existed, we want stories. So you need to come up with a good story and maybe get smart about what keywords to use, you know, what kind of title to use. There's a guy who actually basically stole my whole story on Steph and Nike and the PowerPoint that went wrong, and got 14 million views on YouTube. I say stole tongue-in-cheek. I'm not mad at him. I'm more impressed with that particular game on YouTube. And he has all sorts of tricks of the trade of like how to get the algorithm to click on you. One of them is to use a blurry thumbnail because then it looks more like a candid, you know, a candid photograph, and that looks more authentic. He knows all those tricks of the trade. And yeah, I mean, that can be important. I just think at its root, I'm going to be okay as long as I have stories that somebody would want to use like that. And I've got to have confidence that I'm going to be able to do it and do it again and not worry so much about everything else. As long as it's a good story, then I can eat. That's how I see it.
So what's been your, thus far, your most read or most clicked on article, and why do you think this has been the most successful for you?
Both my most read stories have to do with Nike. I'm not sure what lesson to take from that. The aforementioned one right there, where I, you know, it was a few years later and I talked about why Nike missed out on Steph Curry. And it was a strange story where they didn't really seem to care that much. And they messed up his name and the presentation to re-sign him. And the PowerPoint had Kevin Durant's materials on it. And so it was a really funny story. It was at the peak of Stephness, you know, the peak of Steph mania back then. But it was also this story that people could almost relate to because maybe you screwed up a PowerPoint at work, right? It was a business story and it was also a basketball story. And that's one of the lessons that I took, is that when you get a big hit on your hands, it's not always so easy to foresee it, but it's usually because you've got overlapping topics of interest. And so you're just bringing different kinds of people to the table. And it can just, by an order of magnitude, go viral in the culture. So that one about how Nike lost out on Steph, that did really well. And then to launch my Substack, I wrote how Nike had changed their advertising and some of the business ideas behind that and cultural ideas behind that, and how they were a very masculine company that was selling 2/3 of their apparel to, you know, to men, which is unusual in the apparel business, and how they had really changed their messaging to appeal to women. I would say in a way that wasn't subtle and probably not charismatic, but it was just an article about that. And it was another one of these articles where it did well for its own reasons, but it was a place where I might hear a business podcast talking about it. So I don't always do it consciously. I'm just trying to go with whatever I'm interested in. But it's when you have those overlapping topics of interest, those overlapping subjects, and Nike, I guess, is just a big thing that people don't write about enough, that it can go viral.
So you talked about earlier when you mentioned Shams and Woj and their type of media taking as opposed compared to yours. Where do you feel as those guys fit in the game, and why do you think they're so appealing in that sense? It's almost like they have a game within a game, and people look at their competition on being nosy and kind of dropping some of the info. Is part of that media that you don't do kind of similar to you just wanting to be able to put out a further story and go deep into the story as opposed to 160 characters?
Well, yeah, I think you're making a great point. And I think that's something else that I've benefited from as a market inefficiency, is that in media, there will often be an elephant in the room and we just don't talk about it. And we almost have an omerta. Yeah. Of what we're going to talk about and what we're not going to talk about. Right now in media, news breaking is the mandate. It's been that way for a few years. The newsbreakers get paid the most money. I don't begrudge them the money, but it definitely alters how coverage happens. Once the biggest mandate is news breaking, then you're not saying certain things. You're not telling certain stories because of it. So it matters that this is the big chase between Shams and between Woj. It totally alters what they're doing. And I'm somebody where I'm willing to talk about it. And then connected to that, I think I talk about how agencies are a big part of what happens in the NBA. You know, we've got a strange situation happening where a lot of journalists are editing the main characters out of the story at the behest of the main character, yeah. Right? Because there are agents with juice that are getting certain things done behind the scenes. And the journalist wants the agent to give them the info to break the news first, so they don't even talk about how these agents are really... I mean, when Dan Fagan was basically running the Mavericks, I think that's a very interesting story to a Mavs fan now, isn't it? Some of those stories have done really well for me, just behind the scenes of Shams and Woj. But to what you're saying as to why is that one interesting, I think there's a lot there. If we go to eternal stories, old world stories, Bible stories, I mean, you've got the teacher, you've got the student, they hate each other. The whole thing is very made for TV. And so I'm one of the few people who actually talk about it because I guess I'm just positioned to, and it does well.
Yeah, how do you feel about that coming from a situation like Honor Among Thieves? Because I always use this, Bobby Knight says journalism's one step above prostitution. So I know there's certain levels you don't want to go to and you do, but then when you look over, you're like, kind of like the Young Jeezy thing when he's talking to Nia Long. Like, all right, bruh, that's nasty work what you saying, but rock out. So like when you look at Shams and Woj, is it like, damn, G, now this is why the players don't fuck with us, because you two nerdy bastards just put your nose up anybody's ass and drop some info.
You said it. I mean, you said it, not me.
Yeah. Well, we're going to clip it up. Just make sure you collab post, all right?
I mean, Bobby Knight's not wrong, and I've definitely felt myself on that line, you know, of it's the pressure of it. You feel that pressure to produce, and it puts you in morally compromised situations. I remember Steph had liked something on Instagram, something negative said about an opponent. I can't even remember what it was or what the context was. And I was in the locker room pregame, and I'm asking him about it because the ESPN news desk wants that story. And I just hated myself so much in that moment. I could see the disdain in his eyes for me. And what was even worse is I knew I earned it. And so I look at it sympathetically in a way because, man, you just got to, it's a tough business. Media is a tough business. It's show business. You've got to do what you've got to do to survive in it if you're in it. But it's very difficult to maintain your standards and your morals, as you're saying, and especially if you're in the news breaking, because once again, your main mandate isn't to be the most accurate person talking about what's in the NBA. It's to have the info out first before everybody. Now, how do you do that in many circumstances? It's taking care of the agent who's giving you the info. And I didn't even talk about the other aspect of it, which is that, I mean, one of the major agencies represents most of the people at ESPN NBA and a lot of the players. I mean, this is a maybe tangent to that conversation, but I mean, you just will not hear a lot of negative things said about guys repped by CAA. I don't say it as a criticism of CAA. I think if I was a max level NBA player, I might sign with them because I go, they're just going to say great things about me on ESPN. It's a pretty good deal, but it's a dirty business to what you're saying. And, you know, fortunately I can make some money off that.
Now I attribute that somewhat to the individual who isn't a household name. If you go back and do the research on him, and I think, were you on Business Breakdowns or Acquired?
I was on Business Breakdowns.
You were on Business Breakdowns. And so I remember you giving your story, your backstory, and it was talking about the NBA, the history of the NBA and where it came from. But I recently listened to something on Larry Kuhn. Now, you know that name, right? Mm-hmm. And how he brought in a whole swath of nerds, as you call them, that just are so interested.
Or diverse nerds.
So interested in another aspect of basketball. And so now we've never had anyone speak on the laws of a league. But when Larry Kuhn came along, just because he was interested in it, not because he wanted a job, but he still hasn't been paid for this. And he offers a class for it where that's not, he can get paid for that. But now you just analytics. A lot of guys are getting that job and how that's taken over basketball a little bit. Have you done any research on him or any connection there or any ways that he's inspired you? You know, because I know a lot of folks don't know that name.
Oh, no, I know Larry. I can't do what Larry does. I'm not a CBA expert, but I actually think the analytics people, their power is declining maybe. I think the jocks are winning. I think that might be the theme of this podcast because there's a Hawkeye.
I like that.
Jocks are winning. You know, that's the news I'm here to break. The Hawkeye technology that gives everybody the stats on what's going on out there with motion capture technology, they shifted to Hawkeye from Second Spectrum before. Now, why am I telling you this? Yeah. It's been a disaster. They had to bring Second Spectrum back, and all these analytics guys are on calls with the NBA, and they're just yelling at the NBA league officials to fix it And they're so angry because if you're an analytics guy and the numbers are all screwed up, this is adding hours and hours to your workday, and it sucks. But they don't really seem to have the juice to just get it fixed like that. And the GMs I talk to, they go, yeah, we want it fixed. We don't like that. You know, we want it fixed, but, you know, it's not the end of the world. I kind of think that there was this big analytics moment and feeling as though people with those sorts of skill sets are going to take over everything. But I think water has reached its level, and now you have a mix, and there's an understanding that you need both kinds of people. And you see a lot of former players hired as coaches. It just seems like there's more of a sense that that's not completely the way to win. That's not completely what it is. I think the distinction I make using nerds, you know, instead of nerds versus jocks, I think I call it nerds versus cowboys. You know, for coaching styles, for coaches, like a cowboy is somebody who's bold and has charisma and has rapport with the players. I feel like cowboys in the coaching ranks and even in the GM ranks have been gaining, and nerds have been losing. And that's just what it's been the past few years.
Well, speaking of which, you say using nerds in a certain sense, I want to ask you something about the current Warriors, because Dre won't give me a real answer. So since you predicted them prior to going on their dynasty run, what do you think of them currently, from Draymond to Klay Thompson? Is the dynasty over? And if not, what do they need to do to win another championship?
And let me mention, before you answer, you are the author of The Winning Machine, The Making and Unmaking of the Warriors Dynasty. So I want to give that pretext before you answer.
Yes, yes. Well, Andre's the guy who has me gun-shy about the question you asked, because I went on the radio.
No, you're free to speak
freely. I went on the radio after Klay had his second big injury. And they asked me the question you're asking me, you know, is the dynasty over? And I said, I think what almost anybody would have said in that circumstance, in defense of myself, that, yeah, you know, I didn't even think much about it. And then a year later, I've already moved on to Substack. I think I've washed my hands of the Warriors. I made it a point of pride to basically, you know, get a following and make money without talking about the Warriors. They win the championship, and this clip of me talking on the radio, I don't just hear it like, you know, randomly and DMs and everything. Andre put it up on his Instagram. I was part of a parade of losers and idiots who buried the dynasty when it still had some life in it. So he has me gun shy about the whole thing. I guess I will split the difference and say, hey, no Andre, no dynasty. How about that? How about that? That's the beginning of the end, right? Okay. There.
Maybe I didn't know it was you, or else I wouldn't have put it up. I don't even remember. I honestly don't even remember, because the way they win got that. You know, I kind of help behind the scenes, but the way they win got that was impressive. And it was just a perfect, you know, as an athlete, and Ebba can speak to this, when you do things at this level, and it's the way you go about it, the way we did, everybody had to get it in that moment in time. So you just got caught up in the avalanche.
Buddy, you don't remember it, but I distinctly remember where I learned about it. I was on vacation with my family in Santa Cruz, and I just remember myself on a beach. My wife and my oldest, they're like frolicking in the water with big smiles on their face. And I'm just like shaking my head like, Andre got me, God damn it. You know, why I have to open my big mouth a year ago? I'm still haunted by the Warriors, but I'm glad that it happened. I like when the Bay is happy about basketball, and, you know, I hope there's more life in this. It's looking a little bleak right now, and, you know, I'm no expert on the future of it, but if things didn't end badly, they wouldn't end? I mean, this has to end. Or another one, The Economist.
I tell Dre that all the time. I tell Dre that all the time. I'm like, bro, if it don't end badly, y'all still think y'all got a chance. The only way it can end is terribly, because as good as y'all are, a real fighter's gonna be like, bro, I was 8 points away from being another. Like, it gotta end terribly, or else y'all gonna keep trying. The motherfucker's gonna be 55 years old, running young dudes out of town so they can get another contract extension. right now we're talking about two 35-year-olds that want to be locked up for the next 4 years with a dead ass face that they want to be a champion.
Yeah, but there's an argument to that, and
No, the other side is they shit and go down with how they want. That's my argument for them.
Like, okay, there we go.
I don't care. Like, it's y'all shit. Y'all built it. Rock. It just looked crazy from here. It's nasty work, but do your thing.
No, I'm only saying. I heard Steve say something that it made a lot of sense. Steve said, "I owe it to those guys." And you know, one of the organizations I had the privilege to play for was the Miami Heat, and they go by the same mantra. You know, we take care of those who take care of us. And so there's something to that, is all I'm saying.
No, that's beautiful. No, that's beautiful.
Yeah, it's something that goes to it. And so I guess we got about 5 minutes, right? And so I'm going to throw a couple things at you, and you tell me which one you want to tackle. How about that? Okay. It's been reported on the second day draft. That's one of them. And your thoughts on the second day draft. I think Sean's reported that. Then who do you see winning the finals this year and why? That's another one. The Mark Cuban deal, quite interesting to me. Or NBA expansion. You pick one.
Ooh, boy. I thought we might talk Maverick Carter and the whole gambling thing. I thought...
Oh, I was about to ask you that, too, but nah, never mind.
No, Evan, you can offer that one up.
He sounds like he's ready to drop a dime. Considering the fact that he brought up Dan Fagan and talk about how one person kind of runs a whole team or whatever, I think that could be a topic. But, Dre, let's go deeper into the culture. Do we want Maverick Carter out there via our good friend Ethan Sherwood Strauss?
I like Maverick Carter, for the record.
That's a great question,
too. I like Maverick Carter. Let's not make it about him. Let's talk about this generally, okay? Because I don't know what happened there. But I just think it's interesting. I wonder what you guys think about it, because...
I want to know if you're tough enough to talk Malika Andrews. I can talk anything.
I can't get fired. All right, there's no Slack channel.
Oh, perfect. All right, let's go down there.
I have no HR.
Let's go to two beautiful topics, Malika Andrews and Australia.
Andrews, that one is interesting just because I will say I used to dismiss some of the criticism she was getting as very Twitter bubble. And then I was hanging out with my college roommate, and he said some of the stuff you see on Twitter about, like, does she just go after the black athletes? You know, I heard that she's just really mean to them and, you know, whatever. And it made me go, oh my God, this is like broken containment. Now, I don't think that she targets anybody on the basis of that. I just think she covers the NBA, which is a very black league. So if she's talking about what somebody got involved in, they're going to probably be black. I do think sometimes maybe she feels like she's trying to fulfill the voice of, the voice of order, or, you know, as a host, as moderator, she has a certain responsibility, and maybe people feel like it's too much. Like, you don't need moralizing. You don't need a moral voice on this. And I understand all that. I just think it seems unfair. But here's the thing. It seems unfair, but it almost takes on a life of its own. And it's sometimes you wonder, is this even about the reality of what she's saying, or is it just a good joke prompt? Is it good, as a kind of a launching pad for a meme? So... That's my feeling on it. I don't like seeing when they talk about her, I don't know if it's husband or fiancé-to-be, throwing that out there, that aspect of it feels very ugly to me. But yeah, I think it's, I don't think it's fair, but the problem with the internet is nobody's in charge of the scale of it. Nobody's responsible for the scale of anything. It's just kind of out there collectively, and there's just nothing you can do about it. So sometimes... you know, unfairness happens, and there's just nothing that can be done about it. That's my take.
Well, Ethan, I really appreciate you jumping on. Hopefully this is the first of many conversations that we can have, just exploring the world of basketball on and off with things you're passionate about. I think there's the respect level there where you've expressed that you write about things you really, really, really care about. You know, will this appease to my stakeholders? And we look forward to reading any great articles coming from the House of Strauss. I mean, we look forward to your future. Let's appreciate you.
Thanks so much for having me. The respect is mutual. You guys do a great job, and I look forward to that. Thank you so much.
Point. Forward.
What's up, y'all? Welcome back to another episode of Money Moves, powered by ARK Invest, brought to you by Point Forward. Myself, Andre Iguodala, and my main man, Evan Turner. Today, we bring a special guest from ARK Invest, the chief futurist, Brett Winton. Brett, how you doing today? I'm great. How are you? I am good. I'm gonna give a quick bio for you, just in case the fan base listens to me when they should be listening to you. Funny how the influencer world works. But you joined ARC in February 2014 after working alongside Kathy for 15 years, your time at AllianceBernstein. And as chief futurist, you drive ARC's long-term forecast across convergent technologies, economies, and asset classes, helping them helping ARC dimension the impact of disruptive innovation as it transforms public equities, private equities, crypto assets, fixed income, and the global economy. You also serve on the ARC Venture Investment Committee. Want to talk about that, as I am on an investment committee and just learning your value when you do join committees. We got a lot of NBA players who are getting into the venture world or PE world as partners. It's been very interesting. Kyle Kuzma is GP of a spot now, and just athletes are starting to grow into that realm. Want to know about the investment committee. You also join ARC as the director of research, guiding and managing the proprietary research of ARC's investment team. Prior to ARC, Brett served as a vice president and senior analyst on the research on strategic change, their team at AllianceBernstein, along with Kathy. And in that role, you conducted thematic research, served on the thematic portfolio strategy committee under Kathy, stewardship, and advised portfolio managers across asset classes. Your research topics included global energy in the face of carbon dioxide regulation. I have an amazing story on carbon outputs I want to tell you about.
Hear it.
Also social media and the rise of Facebook. That's interesting. I want to hear your take on sports. We got a lot to talk about. And the reformation of the financial services landscape and the emergence of electric vehicles, which we will definitely get into. Brett, you earned your Bachelor's of Science in Mechanical Engineering at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Welcome to the show. You have an Hall of Famers resume, so congrats to that as you continue to build.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thanks for joining us. One thing, obviously, we were down at ARC Invest a couple months ago. We were able to meet with Kathy, and we had a great, you know, run-in with everybody at the ARC Invest office. Mm-hmm. And they sang your praises numerous in high form. And we were wondering, once we heard, we were sitting with a chief futurist, we were like, that's dope, but what the hell is that? You know what I mean? So can you explain to us, what you do over at ARC Invest, and what the, you know, title of chief futurist is, and how you really are really setting tone and trailblazing.
Yeah, at ARC, we really focus on identifying transformative technologies, and that requires us to understand how quickly they're declining in costs, and then the unit economics of different end buyers at different price points. And so the role of the chief futurist is really to kind of manage the forecasting of those technologies. So how quickly is AI declining in cost year over year? And then how big a market is it going to be? As it turns out, we think AI software is going to be a $13 trillion market by 2030. And there's a lot that goes into like coming up with that number. And so the chief futurist role is really to kind of like guide those top-down forecasts and then control how they translate into our expectations for the individual companies.
That was probably the most eloquent way that someone could explain that and understand it. And so I have a very high level of respect for folks who can explain things to folks who don't understand their world in a manner that they can take it in and, you know, use it going forward.
True signs of a teacher.
Well, I think that actually being able to explain things, actually trying to explain things, trying to write them down, trying to like commit yourself to numbers is the best way to actually learn about them yourself. Hopefully I can explain it well, because it's my entire life's work that I'm doing is being a futurist. And, you know, if I stumble over explaining it, that's a sign to me, and not just at a, you know, what do I do as a job, but at a technology level, at a company level, it's a sign to me of areas that I need to like deepen my understanding. So like you said, like, I think the best learners are also the best teachers, because they use the teaching process to understand where they need to learn themselves.
Oh, no, that's legit. I was wondering, so when you're talking about the ARC Venture Fund and, you know, obviously you helped create it, you're part of it and everything, could you really walk some of our listeners through how you'd be part of it and a vision for the fund and, you know, what you see towards that future. Obviously, you mentioned a couple of fields where by 2030, you believe $30 trillion could be, you know, generated from those avenues. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So from the beginning of ARC, we've been, you know, doing research at the technology level, and then that's required us to talk to a bunch of private companies. And oftentimes companies like had come to us and been like, hey, you know, we're doing a Series B, you should invest with us. And up until, you know, basically last year, we didn't have a mechanism by which to allow clients to invest. And the reason we didn't, you know, along the way, we thought, well, maybe we could do a traditional GP/LP venture structure. And the reason we didn't is because we felt like it was a little bit unfair that only accredited investors, so investors that have a certain net worth, are allowed to invest in innovation companies. And so then in figuring out, like, ultimately, we committed to doing venture when we realized we could package a venture portfolio into what's called an interval fund, which is then interval funds are designed for holding illiquid assets. And they're 40 act funds, meaning that anybody can invest whether or not they're accredited. And so that was kind of like the reason we crossed the threshold of deciding to do it. And then at the individual company level and at the technology level, yeah, we have, you know, very, you know, I'd say differentiated expectations for how the different technologies are going to perform. And some of those expectations, you can't really find them in the public equity market. So Figure AI is a humanoid robot company that's in the venture portfolio. There's not really a comparable pure play asset in the public markets and the public equity space. And so, and we think that humanoid robots are going to be a very big commercial category by 2030. So it's, you know, time to put money in play now. And we didn't have a mechanism by which to do it before. Now with the venture portfolio, we do.
I got a tough question for you. Are you ready?
Yeah, I guess so. I'm not sure. Feel nervous.
No, you're saying, you know, the AI humanoid robots, right?
Yes.
And we've all seen iRobot. And so I'm not thinking about iRobot, but there have been a few instances where they all can connect to the same network and communicate with one another, right? But I'm going a step further in terms of, you know, our systems. And so even the Star Spangled Banner, for example, the like its roots naturally exist from the late 1700s, early 1800s, right? And there's, I mean, obviously what's embedded in there was the fabric of America back then. And so, you know, there were, you know, different levels of human and your rights. And so it's saying that when we're building AI and we talk about it, you know, being equality across the board, so you have everyone's take on how we should, you know, systems should be built based on the whole and not just a few parts. And I have seen where AI will only take a certain perspective and miss out on other perspectives. And then that's when you have policing problems. So I'm thinking about the robots and being the police officers, right?
I see. Yeah.
How do we come to this world where AI is taking everyone into consideration and that everyone is being taken care of? Because this goes to everything, even with, you know, the food imbalance. Like there's so many people that are starving, but we waste, I think, a third of all our food, like globally, like we waste so much food. It's just kind of crazy. And I am seeing how there's a company that you could take a picture of your refrigerator and it'll tell you what you have and it'll give you a recipe based on what's in your refrigerator. So now we're solving for wasting food. And so that's one particular way. But on the policing side, like, how do you see us in terms of building out, you know, government type policy and things of that nature?
Yeah. So, I mean, first, like, I think the premise of your question is, like, won't an AI system that's based upon historical data just kind of like amplify historical biases that are in place and make them worse? And it's possible that it would. Like, you know, if you have kind of the training data, like, embeds certain expectations, it might take those and, if not carefully designed, just like magnify those. Like, it's basically like, oh, you know, people that live in this neighborhood are more frequently criminals and therefore we should arrest them with a higher frequency. Well, that's like profoundly unfair. And so there does have to be like good design principles to make sure that the system doesn't over-index on kind of like a data set that might be biased that it's taking in. And so a lot of companies are doing I'd say, really critically important work to figure out how to make sure that the systems are not just like amplifying previous biases, but operating on objective truth. And I think it's broadly true across technologies that these technologies are profoundly democratizing. Like, take robo-taxis, for example. You know, right now, like riding around in an Uber is actually a luxury purchase. Like $3.50 a mile is really expensive for people. You know, if you convert it into how expensive your car would be if you were to pay $3.50 per mile for all of your miles traveled, it would be like a $200,000 or $300,000 car. There's not many people that can do that. And it's remarkably convenient to be able to be like, I want to start at point A and end up at point B without having to even deal with the pain and agony of driving. And that's what robo-taxi is going to provide. We think that, you know, at scale, it'll price at less than 50 cents a mile, and it'll allow anybody to basically reduce the pain and agony of their commute at an inexpensive price. And so it'll deal a lot of people in to a system where they can effectively afford a chauffeur for less than the cost of buying their own vehicle. And same with AI. So like one of the, I think, underestimated probable developments of AI is that AI systems will serve as amazing private tutors for anyone in the world, just for essentially the cost of an internet connection. And so if you think about all of the countries in which like education is really a privileged access position, like people pay for private schools, there's not real good public education. And even where there is, like the teachers don't show up, it's really hard to like dispense good education to students, and particularly in emerging markets. Well, with an internet connection, if they can have basically one-on-one private tutoring, the only governor on kind of like the amount that they can learn is going to be their own ambition. And so I think there's going to be, you know, broad access to technological advances as a result of the disruptive innovations in the marketplace.
Brett, before we get out of here, I want to ask you one more question considering.
And apologies for...
that was perfect. You did a great job. But I was wondering, I'm looking to buy a Cybertruck. And as you know, as we speak today, Tesla's down like 5% and 40% over the year, that whole stock. But, you know, in April alone, ARK has invested like $100 million. So what is it about Tesla and that whole, you know, situation that you guys are, you know, so sure about where you keep investing and keep doubling down on, you know, on your claim?
Yeah. So the business of Tesla transforms if they're able to deliver robo-taxi capability to their cars. The way to think about it, you're going to buy a Cybertruck for them, you know, and which is a great and amazing like vehicle. Like you'll probably be able to drive it on Mars someday, you know, but they're getting like a one-time operating profit off selling that vehicle to you. If that can turn into a robo-taxi, then it could do, you know, maybe 100,000 miles per year, and they'll take a platform fee just like Uber or Lyft does. And so maybe it's a 50% platform fee at $1 per mile. They'll get $50,000 in revenue per year at like software margins. And so like you can do all the math and you can conclude that instead of making money off every vehicle sold just once, they're going to make maybe 5x more money, maybe 10x more money off every vehicle they have on the road every year, assuming that they can software upgrade the vehicles so that they can drive themselves, which they claim they can, and we believe they can, and we think it's going to happen over the next couple of years. So with that as the framework, you know, it's actually an amazing business that people don't understand right now, because right now it's just making money off of selling you a Cybertruck, which, by the way, is a pretty good business itself. But the robo-taxi business transforms what Tesla is and can become.
And that's amazing. That's that's all I really have.
And by the way, when you get the Cybertruck, you should get full self-driving as well. I use it all the time in LA, and it is life-changing. Just being able to not be stressed about driving around in the city is really a remarkable product as it exists today. And we think it's going to get better.
Buy me a Cybertruck, G.
I don't know. We're transparent. I do drive a Tesla, but someone raised a very, very important point to me in terms of some of the issues that Tesla has had in its practices and his energy towards our demographic, but we continue to market his company. And so I would love to have a conversation with Elon to dispel some of those, because in our culture, like, we speak our truths. And so Elon's got some answering to do. But I do have a down payment. I'll sell it to you. No, you're not allowed to sell it to Cybertruck. But the Cybertruck is an amazing vehicle. I saw BYD did take the lead, the Chinese automaker in electric vehicles sold on the unit side. So I'm keeping a close eye on Tesla. I drove a Tesla back in 2011. Was a lockout when I did internship. I had no idea what it was. Got in a car. I should have put some money in then, but I missed out.
Well, next time we need to hit Brett before we say no to anything. So he knows where thirty exactly. $30 trillion is.
Yeah, he knows. Yeah, we'll
follow
going,
you to that.
Right?
But Brett, for we sure. appreciate you, man. Thanks for your patience. Thanks for your time. And honestly, thanks for what you're doing for the future. You know, I just see myself in like the next 6 or 7 years still being fly, and I'm sure you had something to do with that. So thank you for real. For real.
Yes, right. Yes. And Brett, thank you for the time. Wish we had more time. Like you just said a whole lot. Now I'm gonna go get to read tonight. So I appreciate you for sparking that educational energy.
Point Forward.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Point Forward. Don't forget to follow Point Forward on all social media and subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcast. We appreciate you listening. See you next week. Mm-hmm.